countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
The supply of beef and cattle to beef factories is beginning once again as the blockade at many meat plants around the country are being lifted sporadically overnight and indeed over the past few days. Our Midlands correspondent, Ciarán Mullooly, can bring us up to speed now on developments overnight. Ciarán, good morning. Thanks for joining us. You've been keeping an eye on what's been happening. Bring us up to speed on developments from overnight, please.
Yeah, I suppose the interesting feature, Damien, is reading the statements that are emerging from factories around the country in the last 12 to 16 hours. I've been looking at the statement issued by protesters at the Care factory yesterday afternoon, another one from Keepack in Ballymahon, County Longford this morning, and indeed one from the Independent Farmers of Ireland. And the key thing in it is saying this is that they're saying is the protests are going or gone in many cases, and they're all referring back to the draft beef deal. The plan that was put together, the deal was agreed last weekend, and they're all referring to meetings they hope that will happen now with the Minister for Agriculture. In fact, I noticed one of the protests this morning at Keepack in Ballymahon are saying they won't actually leave the gates of the factory until 1 hour before the meeting with Minister Creed. So at this point in time, it looks like about 10, 11 protests are gone. There could be as many as 10 still in place, but two or three of them on condition at this stage that they're going to move in the coming days.
Okay. Meat Industry Ireland, which is the umbrella body for the meat factories and the meat plants around the country, they issued a fairly hard-hitting statement yesterday. Do you think that that might have had an impact on the ground?
I think it was a factor. I certainly was on the protest line outside the gates of the abattoir there with Keepack in Kilbeggan when it came out yesterday evening, and I spoke to 9 or 10 protesters there about their options. And, you know, all of them, to be quite honest, but all of them were saying, you know, what we're looking for at this stage is an out. The draft is good in many respects, but the issue of trust still remains for farmers. So even though they were reading the statement from MII last night, they were saying, how can we trust them that if we leave the gates of the factory, that the base price will be reasonable next week, that the deal will stick. There was a very strong message from the Meat Industry Ireland, and I understand that, you know, they've made it clear, Damien, that they, even if those blockades disappear today and Monday, they're not going to resume production at the factories until the majority of the sites are actually gone. I understand this morning there is an effort to start killing lambs again next week, but the factories, the main factories, I gather, will not open until all or pretty much majority of them of the sites are gone. And indeed this morning I understand the main industry is still stepping up its moves to try and meet the Minister for Justice, Charlie Flanagan, to see how the remaining sites, albeit with smaller numbers of protesters, can be actually cleared in the coming days.
Okay, but I do believe though that some cattle are getting through in some cases.
Yeah, as I say, the ones that Slaney Meats and the ones that opened earlier are certainly in a position to restart operations at this stage. But there are difficulties in some areas around the country. And I think, as I say, the protesters themselves are saying that, you know, they're just waiting for a base price. They're waiting for an indication of what's going to happen. For instance, yesterday at Keepack in Quebec, they said the company wouldn't meet them, the factory manager wouldn't meet them, and they weren't able to get a base price. They said if they had got a reasonable price, they'd be gone at this stage. And I actually think that may be the case in many of the instances. They're looking for something that'll give them an opportunity to go away now and let the deal, as it was, take its force.
Just to put it in perspective, I suppose, for listeners, this time last year, upwards on 37,000-38,000 cattle were killed this week last year, and I think this week it's 8,000. And we heard concerns from the Restaurants Association earlier this week that there could be a shortage unless things improve. So that's where we are in that. Just finally, Ciarán, the majority of beef farmers, particularly those I spoke to at the ploughing championships, and the farm organisations, all of them, including the beef plan, they want the blockades to be lifted to allow cattle in and to allow farmers who have cattle ready to get them into the factory so they can get paid and they can pay other bills. Who's left at these blockades?
Well, that's a good point. And I raised this yesterday at a couple of different factory gates, because statements from places like Charleville, from the factory owners, were pointing pointing out that many of the protesters were not customers of the beef factories involved at all. And, you know, I questioned three or four people yesterday at Quebec, and they made it very clear they were customers. They said perhaps what's going on here is that we're smaller producers. We're people who are not bringing the scale of numbers to the factories that others are bringing. And I suppose that's at the core of why we've had dissent in many areas, Damien, to the actual deal in the first instance. Many of these producers I spoke to are people who may not be in the quality meat assurance scheme at all. And some of them are still feeling they're not going to get those bonuses that have been agreed or in the deal from last weekend. And perhaps why that's the reason why there was remaining dissent up until this morning and indeed for the next couple of days until talks get underway again.
All right, but later on we'll be chatting to Irish Examiner columnist Gerard Howland on that very point. Ciarán Mullooly, Midlands correspondent with RT, keeping an eye on what's going on nationally as well in relation to the beef blockades. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. So how damaging has this dispute been on our international markets? Remember, €2.5 billion worth of Irish beef is exported across the world on an annual basis. So customers all over the world, I'm sure, aware of this situation. I'm joined here in studio by the CEO of Bord Bia, Tara McCarthy. Tara, good morning.
Good morning, Damien.
Thanks very much for coming in. So as factories were stopped killing, as restaurants and supermarkets warned of shortages, how damaging has this been to the industry?
It's clear that this is an unprecedented time in our beef industry, and it is a challenge. And I guess there's a number of ingredients that have brought us to this. There's no doubting that the base price for farmers has been very, very low this year. And the fact that they have been forced into to sell their products at a lower than their costs is hugely challenging for them. However, when I look at the market, and I guess that's really what I want to talk about today, we're an export-orientated country, and there have been good years for our beef industry. If we look back to the last 10 years, we have really made huge progress on being better than the European average for the price of our beef. Six of the last 10 years, we have been much, much better. European beef this year is at a very, very low price. It has fallen throughout Europe. Now, if I get to the specific issue of what's happening here today for ourselves, because we're exporting, we've had a supply disruption. And that's a very clinical way of saying it, but we haven't delivered on the promises that we've made to our customers overseas. We are competing in a global environment, which means when we don't turn up, somebody else will. So Bord Bia's role is threefold. We don't sell beef. And let me be very, very clear on that, because at the ploughing, some people felt maybe we did. We don't. What we do is three things, essentially. We build awareness. We want everyone to know about Irish beef. We look to put proof behind the reputation. And what I mean by that is it's easy to take a photo. It's easy to say Irish beef is lovely. What does that actually mean? And that's where in that proof, we talk about the quality assurance, the traceability, the commitment to sustainability, and then we promote. And what's happened over the last couple of weeks is how we promote, which is around bringing new buyers, the target guys. This is not commodity. It's the really top level buyers. We bring them to the country and we showcase our farmers because we are very proud of the work that we do and what they do, more importantly. We look and we go to processors so that those buyers can see the factories. And obviously we then talk to them about the promotions that they can do. We've obviously slowed down a lot on that over the last number of weeks, because clearly if we don't want them to come down to see blockades or see strife on our island. So what we've done is we've cancelled or we've pulled back on our promotional agenda. Similarly, we do promotions in store, which this means is putting big flags up around Ireland and drawing attention to the category for consumers. Sure. Again, when we're not reliable on the sourcing, we've pulled back on that.
Okay, but what has the reaction been among our international customers? Are they aware of this? First of all, are they worried?
Absolutely. We're living in a global world. If something goes on Agriland, it's just as available internationally as it is here. This is big news. We are a big producer of beef. We are an important supplier into the EU market. So of course our customers are aware of it. We've been in a huge dialogue with them, all of our offices. We've 14 offices around the world and we've been talking to them on a daily basis, trying to look to give them support, trying to give them clarity, trying to manage their expectations, and clearly doing this in partnership with their suppliers as well. And what were our big challenges? The uncertainty that's unfolding. But what we're looking to do is to build certainty back in, and that's why we'd welcome the opening of more and more of these factories. We have a huge trade show coming up in 2 weeks, Enuga. It's the biggest trade show in the world. We have a big presence at that. It's our showcase where we're going to meet all of our key customers, and the meat industry will be there. We need to have this very, very clear on that day to say that our beef is available and it is a premium product that we are proud of and that we're working as one again.
But what about the reputational damage? Has there been reputational damage?
Well, it depends. There's a short-term hit because we've left people down. That happens, and that can happen on different occasions. And our more important piece is to start building solutions into this as well. People have looked at their options, and you never want your customer who's loyal to you traditionally to look for other options. And that's a vulnerability for us, without a doubt. We've spoken to nearly all of our customers throughout the last 2 weeks, and when there's nothing a customer hates more than an empty shelf. It's as simple as that. And whilst they're loyal to their shelves and their own business first. So they have looked at options. They have looked to substitute us for the next 2 weeks because we weren't available and we'd no commitment to supply there. What we're now looking to, and that's only some, clearly that's not all, but clearly what we now need to do is ensure that we're not a blank spot on that shelf, that we have to start from scratch again, because building business, building contracts, building reputation, it takes time and it's very quickly damaged.
So we have lost customers, but you're hoping it'll be in the short term.
We have lost business, not customers. So what I mean by that is when we're talking to our customers, they're looking at interim solutions, but they're not delisting Irish Beef. But we have to make sure that that interim solution doesn't look anything like a permanent one.
Okay. Will you talk to me briefly about the quality assurance scheme? This is, I suppose, it's an extra layer on top of the minimum standard which farmers must actually meet to qualify for their single farm payment. The quality assurance scheme is something Borbé introduced where you audit farmers, they have a higher bar to cross. If they meet that bar, they get a premium. They're saying that nearly every farmer now is in the quality assurance scheme, and it's actually, instead of being a premium, it's a standard.
Now, let me correct you on that. So we introduced the quality assurance scheme. You're right, it's been around for over 25 years, but it's continuously reinventing itself and improving itself. And 90% of our exports are now represented by quality assured farms, roughly speaking, 50,000 farms. And it is true. It's when I said to you that we're about building reputation and creating proof, our quality assurance is proof for those key customers that we're doing something better than the average, that we're committed to sustainability. So when I want to talk to a customer about Ireland's commitment to sustainability, I have vast quantities of data that I can go to that customer with. But then when you start mixing that language up with it's a premium, it's not a premium, etc., that's one of the biggest areas of confusion that we've had. And let me just take a minute to walk through that one. There's a bonus that farmers get. It's an in-spec bonus. And what in-spec means, it's suitable to the top markets that I'm looking for. It's what my top customers are asking me for. And what those top customers are asking for is four things. They're asking for younger animals. That's the age. And we've heard a lot about 30 months, but that is what the customers have mentioned. They're talking about animals that don't move less than four times from different farms. They're talking about the confirmation of it. And they're talking about the animal being part of quality assurance. So quality assurance is one element of that in-spec bonus, but it isn't the in-spec bonus. And so many of our farmers have really been misled sometimes and confused on this one because the language has been used interchangeably. It's sometimes called the Borbé bonus. It's sometimes called the quality assurance bonus. It's not. Quality assurance is a system. It's part of the proof points that we have created to go to premium customers. Without it, we can play in the commodity world.
So you're saying it gives Ireland an edge over other countries because they don't have this QAS scheme that...
Exactly. Oh, okay. They don't speak to this. They don't have voluntarily 49,000 farmers and growing. They don't have data that shows them sustainability commitments, etc.
Okay, one final point, Tara, is in relation to the Q mark, which we all know, we all see on meat products when we go into the supermarket. We see the Q mark with the tricolour on it. It gives it the impression that it is Irish and it's been audited and by Borbé. But another complaint from farmers is that beef from abroad is being brought in here and it's been processed in Irish factories. It's not Irish at all. It's not meeting the same standards and it is qualifying for the Q mark. Is that the case?
Absolutely not. Like, there's only a very short answer to that. No. And I'll tell you why. And it's really disappointing that we're even having this conversation, Damien, but I really want to have it so that I can just close this down. Absolutely, beef is entitled to come in and out of this country. We're in Europe and it is not illegal or it is not dodgy practice for anybody to import beef or export beef from this country. That's an open economy. That's life. But a quality assurance, and what I'm saying here is it's a traceability system. So what happens in order to get the Q mark is three elements to it. Number one, it comes from a quality assured farm. So Bord Bia have inspected that farm, which we've just talked about. We've inspected that farm every 18 months and we have checked the traceability, the animal welfare, the sustainability credentials, etc. And that's done by our auditors, and our auditors are inspected to make sure that that is clear. After that then, meat processors again apply to be part of this scheme, and we put forward that we inspect everything that they do. And we inspect it to ensure that the traceability systems are in action. And we also not just inspect them every 18 months, but we also do spot checks on them. We can arrive whenever we want to look at that factory. And we can do reconciliations to say what meat came in, what meat goes out. And then we go to the consumer so that we can then show that consumer what's on a Q-mark and promote that product to them. However, we export our product and we call it Irish beef internationally as well, quality assured beef. So we also go internationally and inspect factories to make sure that a product that is coming from Ireland, born, reared, slaughtered from an Irish farm that has been quality assured, that is the only product that is able to come through
the
Q-mark.
So beef that might be from the UK and has a double mark on it, as was the case earlier this week.
Two things. A human error, number one. Something that was spotted, a photograph taken. We contacted the processor immediately. They clarified that it was error. In fact, it was slaughtered in two places, which shows you how big an error it was according to that label. We went then and we had that product withdrawn from the market because we felt that was not good enough, and we spot audited the factory in question within 24 hours. So we take our reputation very, very, very seriously. But this is not about us. We take the trust of the Irish consumer and every global consumer who buys Irish beef as one of the most important things that we do, and we would never take a risk with that.
All right, okay. Tara McCarthy, CEO of Bord Bia, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And before that, we heard from Ciara Mullooly, our Midlands correspondent, saying that blockades are being lifted and more have been lifted around the country overnight. Now, as millions of teenagers took to the streets all across the world yesterday to highlight the climate emergency, it was a reminder of how we need to change our ways in many fronts to help halt its effects. In this country, a lot of the focus has been on how farmers will play a leading role in contributing to the reduction of our overall carbon footprint. Indeed, instead of being seen as a cause, farmers need to be seen as a solution. Land is the precious canvas of food production, the soil, the nourishment, and 65% of the land in Ireland is agricultural, with another 11 or 12% under forestry. Last month, the International Panel on Climate Change published a detailed report on land use and climate change. But does Ireland need to adopt a new land use policy to tackle climate change? Joining me in studio now is environmental campaigner Sive O'Neill, who is a lecturer in environmental politics at UCD and a spokesperson for Friends of the Irish Environment, and Trevor Donlan, who is head of economics of Chagask, working extensively on the issue of agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. You're both very welcome. Trevor, I'll begin with you. Most of our farmland is grassland grazed by cattle and sheep, but do you agree that if we are to avert catastrophic climate change, we must transform how we produce food and how we use and manage land?
Broadly, yes, Damien. Good morning. I would agree with that statement. We certainly need to do something different. We can't continue in the way that we have been historically. Emissions from greenhouse gases have been increasing in recent years, and that is a serious issue. The sector will always be changing to some degree in response to economic factors. We've seen the expansion of the dairy sector since the milk quota was removed. But the big next development that we need to see in the ag sector is the adoption of these measures that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the farm level.
Now, the government's climate change advisory group, they proposed, as we know, earlier this summer, reducing the suckler herd by up to half. It was a real headline grabber. But you argued that this would actually be counterintuitive. Why?
It would potentially be a problematic. I mean, if we had a very substantial reduction in the suckler herd, depending on how it happened, if we did have a very substantial reduction in the suckler herd in Ireland, there's a big question as what happens to the land that's being used in that production currently. Where does it go? What does it end up in? You know, if it all ended up in forestry from an environmental perspective, that would be a good outcome because we would sequester a lot of carbon in the trees that were planted. But can we actually control what would actually happen? You know, there's a possibility that a significant portion of that land could go into dairy farming, for example. And when land goes in out of dry stock and into dairy farming, it gets farmed more intensively. You'll have more cows per hectare, you'll have more fertiliser being used, and ultimately more greenhouse gas emissions.
So you say be careful what we wish for in that regard?
I think you need to be careful, you know, in terms of proposing very radical solutions unless you've thought through the consequences of those actions, yeah. Basically.
Saif, agriculture accounts, as we know, for about a third of greenhouse gas emissions in Ireland, and livestock farming, it gets the brunt of the blame for that. But just on that point, isn't permanent pasture a better carbon sink and better for the soil than cultivating land and rotating crops, which may lead to a quicker land degradation over time?
Well, just to step back a little bit there, so agriculture accounts for about a third of all Irish greenhouse gas emissions, and the emissions here are not the carbon dioxide emissions we associate with fossil fuels. It's methane and nitrous oxide. But what's really driving agricultural intensification and what drives up methane emissions is actually reactive nitrogen that we add to the soil through synthetic fertilisers and imported feed. And it's only because of this extra loading of nitrogen that we can grow more grass, produce more cattle, and as a result, we get the methane as an outcome of that. So when we think about reducing those gases, we have to step back and think about what our real policy aims are. And I suppose from an environmental perspective, we would be looking at maximising net nourishment per hectare at the lowest environmental cost. So that's different. So if you say we're just going to convert livestock to or pasture over to tillage, that narrows the range of options, and we should be actually broadening out all the options so that we can consider all the different ranges of land use. And in particular, we should be thinking about the role that forestry should play. The current plans for upscaling commercial forestry are not really going to sequester any carbon in the long term. We need to be converting land to permanent woodland using native species. We need to be rewilding large areas of land, and some recent studies suggest that if we really are serious about sequestering carbon and actually drawing it back out of the atmosphere and locking it into the land, as well as, you know, protecting ecosystems and biodiversity, we're looking at using up to 40% of our land, 40% of our land area. So in addition to this competition between different forms of agricultural production, we need to think about land uses that are going to draw carbon from the atmosphere and sure. keep it there.
But of course, we do need to feed the world and feed ourselves, and demand for food and particularly animal protein is on the increase, and I believe demand for food is going to grow by 75% by 2050 as the global population hits between 9 and 10 billion. Now, if there is going to be a demand, and it is mentioned in that IPCC report, you know, animal protein is referred to as obviously a food that we will need in the future. Do you buy the Irish argument that We're doing it very well here? It's grassland, it's extensive farming, very sustainable compared to where beef is produced in other parts of the world. And if we do the right thing and cut back on our beef production and transfer the land into something else, it'll just be picked up in Brazil or somewhere where they're less sustainable.
Well, firstly, we just can't feed the world with animal products. We are going to have to start investing in ways to ramp up our production of vegetable proteins. There is absolutely no way you can sustainably
feed
the world.
But Irish farmers can't change that. As far as they're concerned, if that happens, happens. But in the meantime, they need to make a living.
Yeah, true. So that's a separate issue. But firstly, we cannot feed the world with dairy and beef products. It just is not feasible. It's not feasible. There isn't enough land.
But we don't. There is a mix at the moment.
No, but you're saying we need animal protein. I'm saying it plays a very small role in what we need to do to feed the world. And the second thing is the question of efficiency. Now, that boils down to a kind of a complex argument about trade, because carbon leakage can happen in any context where you have trade agreements. So it's a question of what level of competition there is in a given market and what different standards there are. And the thing about it is that while Irish beef might be a very high quality, it's not necessarily the most efficient compared to other countries. Other EU member states, including the UK, I hear them on the radio all the time, claiming that their beef is also highly efficient. So we have to get away from this argument that somehow we're exceptional. Production is highly polluting in certain ways. We are polluting our water courses, we are damaging our land, and we are investing too much nitrogen into this production.
Trevor, let you come back in. A lot of points there that's been made.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with some of the points that Sive has made. And the key issue that I would add to that is we need to look at not just the environmental efficiency of what we're producing, but the economic efficiency of what we're producing. And the unfortunate reality is that there is no profit to be made from beef farming by and large in this country. And we need to face into that reality as well. You know, being environmentally efficient, okay, that's great for the environment, but the fact that it's not a system that produces money, I think, is problematic for the sector. And it's one of the reasons why we should be thinking about what exactly we're producing in Ireland in the future.
So, the other thing is that aren't we misleading when we talk about grass-fed when we're importing so much meal from abroad to feed to our cattle?
Well, this is an argument that annoys me, I have to say, because if you look at the type of pasture-based systems globally, ours is one of those systems where the least feed is actually used. I mean, we do import animal feed, certainly, but we also import food residues. A significant portion of what is actually imported as animal feed is food residues, which would otherwise get burnt or get dumped. So in another context, one could talk about that being an example of the circular economy. I don't think trade is a bad thing. You know, if we can import grains from other parts of the world that we can't really grow very well
soy
here.
From the rainforest, though, potentially down the road, isn't that what the it's been cleared for?
Yeah, but I think
soy to feed cattle in Ireland as well as other parts of the world.
But people need to realise that the volumes we're talking about in terms of the animal's diet are actually very small. I mean,
right.
Most of what an animal cattle consume in Ireland is grass and silage. And, you know, we're topping up the animal's feed requirement with small amounts, comparatively small amounts of imported
feed.
Okay,
kind of a final question to both of you, and that's in relation to technology. Is the technology out there to reduce methane emissions without reducing the actual herd numbers?
Yes, potentially. It depends on how fast the sector grows in the future, and principally how I'm talking about how fast the dairy sector grows in the future. There's definitely a pathway there with enough adoption of the technologies we've already identified, plus new technologies that will come on stream in the future to manage the greenhouse gas emissions in Ireland.
Yeah. So would you accept that if technology is there and we can reduce the methane emissions that you mentioned earlier on from livestock, be it, you know, with better genetics, better breeding, using less nitrogen, and reducing our fertiliser use, you know, is that a good alternative, or is it just the case, no, we need to stop livestock production?
Well, if there was a techno fix available, I think we should be using it. But unfortunately, it isn't in place at scale that we can implement now. We need to reduce emissions yesterday, 15 years ago. In fact, emissions from the agricultural sector were reducing, and it was only after 2011 that they started to increase again in anticipation of the elimination of the milk quota. So we were on a downward trajectory, and really what we need to be thinking now is how to get back to the point we were at in 2011. We need to think about maybe capping our use of nitrogen, because actually we are a net importer of food energy. So we do export protein, but we are importing energy. And unfortunately, it's the basic physics that matters when you're talking about climate change. And we need to think about how to rebalance our agricultural model
right.
in a way that does produce food sustainably, that does provide incomes for farmers and sustainable livelihoods without actually compromising our water quality and our climate.
Well, it's great to have you both here. I think there's so much more that the environmental pillar and agriculture actually have in common that a lot of people out there probably don't actually get. And that is the way it's going to be in the future of working together for the betterment of the farmers' livelihoods, the betterment of the environment, and maintaining rural communities, and indeed looking after the precious soil that grows our food and crops and all of that. So thank you both very much. Time flies, I know, but we will come back to this in the future. Trevor Donlan of Chagask and Sive O'Neill, thank you both very much indeed for coming in to studio this morning. As I said, it is something that we will continue to focus on here on Countrywide. But now let's go back to this iconic sporting moment from 28 years ago.
Clark gets the ball. Now he's got support. Charging through is Gordon Hamilton. Has he got the pace to get there, the big flanker? Yes! Lansdowne Road erupts then.
Irish flanker Gordon Hamilton scoring his first and only try for Ireland against Australia in the quarterfinals of the second Rugby World Cup in Lansdowne Road back in 1991. To this day, it arguably remains Irish rugby's World Cup Seamus Darby moment, although there is that famous win over the same opposition in 2011. But in eight World Cups, we've never made it past the quarterfinals, and in 2007, famously, didn't even get that far. So as the 2019 tournament gets underway in Japan, here's hoping our luck changes. I'm joined on the line now from Limerick by former Irish international Fiona Steed to give us her view on Ireland's chances, but also to tell us about an event tomorrow morning in Bruff. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning, Damien. Lovely to speak to you.
And you too. It's up and running and the excitement is palpable everywhere. Isn't it kind of telling that we don't have an awful lot of memories from the World Cup compared to the few we might have from the soccer lads over the years? We never seem to hit it on form.
I know. It sort of always seems to be that we don't hit our peak when it comes to the World Cup. You know, I remember being in Adelaide when Quinny, you know, saved Irish rugby with his try against Argentina as well. I mean, that's a standout moment for me from 2003. But I'm really hopeful, you know, this time round that it'll all come together tomorrow morning and we'll get a good, you know, if we get off to a good start, then, you know, the group is there for us to take. Unfortunately, then the quarter final will be the hardest quarter final, arguably. We've gone through our chalk. I'm really hoping that we've come out the other side of it. We had a, you know, two reasonable performances against Wales, obviously the victory at the Aviva, you know, the last day. So I'm hoping that it's an upward trajectory again. And tomorrow is telling, though. We have our hardest pool game first up, so there's no opportunity to play around with or to, you know, everybody knows this is game on and you just have to get on with it.
Will you tell us about the big breakfast you're having in Bruff tomorrow, Fiona?
Oh yeah, this is a great event. We've got 250 club members coming, boys, girls, men, women, the whole lot, coming for breakfast tomorrow morning, starting serving at 7:30. And really it came about, like, I coach the under-11s with Mickey, Pat and Dan, and I was like going, jeepers, we won't have any training or people won't come or you won't know what to do because we train at 10. So I came up with this sort of idea, look, it would be get everybody in the club and then we'll train whenever the match finishes, you know, we'll train. So yeah, and it's to build, I suppose, the club spirit at the start of the season, you know, a bit of publicity about it and just to tell everybody that Bruff is a fantastic rugby club in the middle of the country and we have girls rugby from under 10 to under 18. We have boys and the girls can play with the boys at under 8, 9, 10 as well, all the way up. Like, they have a lovely boy, you know, lads under 20 side, under 18 side, very successful last year, and a great senior side. And I suppose it's just, we were there last night, you know, doing up the place, putting up the flags and the bunting, and it's just a really good occasion. Everybody bought into it, which is fab.
Great, great indeed. Listen, Fiona, thanks a million for joining us there from Limerick this morning. And you'd be interested to know that RT Radio 1, as part of our Rugby World Cup coverage, wants to send you and a friend all the way to the final. Could Ireland be there? Listen to this for all the details on how you can win.
Rugby World Cup Japan 2019. RT Radio 1's got you covered. And as part of our coverage, we want to send you and a friend all the way to the final. For your chance to win return flights to Japan, a four-night stay in Tokyo, tickets to the final, and €1,000 spending money, answer this question. The winner of the 2015 Rugby World Cup was A, New Zealand, or B, England. To enter, text the word Japan, followed by your answer and name to 57111. Cost of entry is €1. Lines close at 11 a.m. on Monday the 30th of September. Don't text after that time, as you will be charged, but your entry will not be included. This competition is open to residents of the Republic of Ireland only, over 18s, and terms and conditions apply. See rte.ie/competitions, where the lucky winner will also be revealed.
So get cracking on that. Now, the beef dispute, which erupted into bitter and divisive blockades over the past 2 months, has raised plenty of questions regarding the future of our largest farming enterprise. But it's also highlighted a slow but emerging disconnect between farmers and the farm lobby organisations, not to mention their traditional political homes of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Is this dispute symptomatic of a broader societal rebelling against the establishment? Well, joining me now in studio is Irish Examiner columnist and former political advisor to Fianna Fáil, Gerard Howland. Gerard, thanks for coming in. You know, as a non-farmer, urbanite observer of the events of the recent weeks, how do you summarise it?
I think it's the end of an era for farm politics as we've understood it, which began essentially in 1966 with the famous march on Dublin. The National Farmers Organization became the IFA. The IFA then subsequently 20 odd years later became embedded in social partnership as part of that structure, was effectively part of a quasi unelected government for over a decade. And that structure, if you like, was immensely powerful. It was politically feared. It delivered a lot, and the entire era is now over.
And why do you think it's over? What has given you that impression?
Well, a couple of things happened. One is social partnership is over and won't be coming back. So a major platform of access, power, influence is gone. Secondly, I suppose things have changed a lot. I was particularly taken by the whole role of WhatsApp in a lot's been happening with these smaller organisations.
The Beef Plan movement, that was the basis of their establishment.
Absolutely. And of course, these new technologies undermine existing structures across the board. Media is a prime example. But it means that structures where there are meetings, where there are chairmen, secretaries, county boards, that's all withering on the vine, because people don't have to go to the meeting anymore because technology, whether it's Twitter or WhatsApp or whatever, allows them both to keep themselves informed but to keep themselves engaged. So everyone now has a platform on their own gizmo, and this means that structures where you have the voice of the group delivered through, you know, the chair, the secretary, the county committee, the national organisation, that's become so porous, of which farming is just one example, that these structures, trade unions similarly, can find our situation extremely challenging. So it's a changed world, both in terms of technology, in terms of all voluntary organisations. It's a changed world specifically for farm politics, and also, I suppose, then on the ground in terms of beef specifically, it's very changed, because figures as diverse as Mary Robinson and Leo Varadkar are telling us that we should eat less, and it seems we are. Tastes are changing.
And do you think that that is something that has been red rag to a bull, not to be mixing my metaphors on that, in terms of some of the things that Leo Varadkar has come out with? They may pass over the heads of most people, but in deep rural Ireland, where, you know, values and traditions are still very strong when it comes to faith and obviously farming, his remarks earlier this year about "I don't eat as much meat as I used to" was drove farmers bananas. And the other one was the comments about the paedophile priest to Micheál Martin. That was something else that may have bypassed you and I, but in deep rural Ireland was quite offensive. So is there a big disconnect, as I said there, between, you know, the traditional farming vote, which was always very strong for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, is that now being detached?
Well, I say two things, Damien. First of all, I think if there are beneficiaries from what's happened over the past few weeks, I think one of them may be rural independent TDs. I mean, I don't think Michael Fitzmaurice's seat was in danger, but I see him getting significantly more votes. The second Healy Ray seat, which might have been a vulnerable enterprise, I think might be strengthened. Where it will go is between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Pacific constituencies remain to be seen. But going back to those remarks that caused such consternation among farmers, you see, these are symbols of something deeper, and the deeper things these farmers know are real. So, for example, in rural constituencies, farmers are a diminished force. I know a lot of TDs very well. These people are absolutely expert at counting votes. And they know that in rural constituencies, people in housing estates, in towns, are a much, much bigger force in terms of vote, in terms of power, than they were. And farmers proportionately are diminished. In terms of so the metropolitanism of the government, which is in remarks that may not have been particularly well judged, that drive farmers mad, they are symbols of a fact that the country as a whole, we as a population as a whole, are living much more metropolitan lives, even if it's only a housing estate in Goree or wherever, or any of these big Midland towns.
So we have a minute left. So really what we're seeing here with still blockades going on, despite the president, the Taoiseach, ministers, farm organisations saying get away, that these people now, as you're saying, they're isolated, they're voiceless, they don't have leadership, and there's nobody that they can grab onto to be a voice for them?
Well, they've abandoned the structures that might. The continuing divisions weakens them further. That's a sign of anger. It is enabled, as I say, by these new technologies, and the continuing division makes them ever weaker. They cannot force people to eat or to buy what they don't want to eat.
Okay. Gerard, we're going to leave it there, but it's a great piece that you wrote. People should go online and they will find it there in the on the Examiner from your column on Wednesday. And again, it's a debate worth returning to again. But Gerard Howland, thank you so much indeed for joining us in studio this morning.